Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
I was about to say good morning, Fiona, but people could be listening at any time. So good day, Fiona.
Good day, Gail. How has your writing week been?
My writing week's been very interesting because I've reached the end of my book and now I'm going back and I'm trying to tie up loose ends. And I don't know if I talked about this last week, actually, but it's really quite hard. I've written these things where I obviously thought I was going somewhere very clever with this. And I remember the feeling of, oh, yes. And now they're just loosely flying pieces of ribbon that have got nothing to do with how the book actually ends. Mm-hmm. So now I'm having to go back and either force them into the plait, mm-hmm. or cut them off, which is obviously a hard and sad thing to do. So that's where I'm at. I'm neatening up the plait of my book and hoping by the end it will look like a good plait that was planned from the beginning and not a wild, crazy hairstyle that should never have existed. How about you, Fiona? How's your writing week been?
It's been okay, but I did encounter a rather strange stumbling block that I wanted to talk about. I'd written a few chapters and I sent them to my older daughter to look at because she's a very good first reader. And she came back to me and she said, "Mom, there's this scene here that you have lifted straight out of." And then she named a book that she and I had both read recently. And I realized she was absolutely right. I had unconsciously been inspired to the point of actual unintentional plagiarism by this book. And it was very alarming and made me kind of question my sanity in an interesting way. And I was wondering, has that ever happened to you? Or have you ever looked at another book and seen your own book in it? Or, you know, has this ever come up for you in the past?
So I'm not going to talk about it in detail, but I have read a book that I am convinced that the writer did exactly that, unconsciously copied one of my books. Mm-hmm. It had a much nicer cover than my book had. And it was quite upsetting. But as you're speaking, I'm thinking, you know, I have a terrible, terrible memory. I can't remember a book a week after I've read it. I have to go back and read the blurb to remember what it was about. And I wonder how often I do this. You know, we probably, this time you were lucky because Julia had read the same book as you.
Yes.
How often do we do it without realizing, is it just part of how a writer gets inspired or is it very bad behavior indeed?
You know, in a way, I think it's both. certainly if it were intentional copying of someone else's work, that would be very bad and has to be weeded out and stopped immediately. But that we are inspired by a hodgepodge of things that we've seen on social media, things that we've read, things that have happened to us, things that have happened to other people in our lives. And we mush it all together and come up with these things that we think we've kind of created out of thin air. And I guess this is why well-produced books have to go through several layers of people before they can be published, because I would hope that that kind of thing would be caught. And I'm so grateful that mine was caught at an early stage.
But nobody's read everything. You know, that's the thing. Nobody's read every book you've read, so it's difficult. And also, I mean, it goes to that whole thing about there is no such a thing as a new plot.
Yes.
You know, and so to some extent, we are copying the storylines we know and we are using the storylines we know. It's a very interesting issue, actually, when you start digging down into it.
It is interesting, and I don't know exactly what the solution is. I just hope we can trust the process. But it does come up where you see things that look very much like other things and things that seem to have been inspired but not credited to other things. And very often it can be completely unintentional. But Gail, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
Okay, so I need to start first with an unusual thing. Last time I spoke about Anna O.
Yes.
And I said I don't talk about books before I finish them because you never know what can go wrong in the end. But I was so confident that it wouldn't go wrong in the end, that it was possibly one of the greatest books ever written. And I would never normally say something bad about a book, But I have to, because I was so great about Anna O, the end disappointed on an epically disappointing level. So I am withdrawing my unfiltered recommendation. I still think it's magnificent for the first three quarters, but then it does go wrong. Just for people who went out and bought it immediately on hearing me say so, I'm sorry. Apologies. Read it. Let me know what you think. I would be very interested to know what other people think about that. So I want to talk about a thriller that didn't disappoint me to balance out the universe, which is one of my always read authors is Ruth Ware.
Yes.
And she's just written lovely books. And I read this one on holiday and it's called One Perfect Couple. And it was a premise I didn't love. It was a premise about people on an island and stuck on an island. I don't like closed room murders. I don't like bad weather books. And they're stuck on an island because of bad weather.
I like all these things.
What I do like is playing with the idea of reality TV shows. And that is the premise for this book. These people are on this island taking part in a reality TV show about couples and how couples relate and last, but you can be voted off not as a couple, but as part of a couple.
Right.
And this woman comes on not because she wants to be there, but because her partner desperately wants to be there. He's a failing actor. He feels this will revive his career. They come on. And he is sent home first. And then some terrible weather comes. The people are abandoned on the island. And we discover not everyone is as they seem, because that's a must-have for a thriller. And how they came to all be there is maybe not as it seems either. Ta-da-da-da. And it was very gripping. Wonderful read. What about you?
So I've been reading a book called All Fours by Miranda July. Very, very interesting. People who've read her before know that she very much mines her real life for material for her novels. And this is based on herself, I would imagine, maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago. And it is a book essentially about perimenopause.
Okay.
The mania of perimenopause. And I think many of us who've been through it know that the hormonal fluctuations can make one a bit crazy from time to time. But they make this character crazy on an epic scale. They send her on a journey of sexual exploration, which had my eyebrows shooting up through my hairline. The title, All Fours, is maybe a bit of a clue that you're in interesting territory here. She writes very, very well. My only objection is that she's slightly feeding into the stereotype of the crazy woman, the woman who's so at the mercy of her hormones that she can't be trusted. She goes mad. She honestly goes absolutely crazy. And it's the kind of stereotype that means that women of a certain age they find it difficult to get jobs because people think, oh, you know, she's going through this transition. Is she going to be completely nuts? And really, women aren't actually completely
not
nuts.
Really.
So it made me question all kinds of things. It certainly is very gripping, very eye-opening, and I'd recommend it. It was an interesting read.
It sounds fascinating. I think that's one I'm going to have to read.
And another author of some very interesting reads indeed is our guest today. Our guest today is Vernon Head. Vernon is the author of the nonfiction book, The Search for the Rarest Bird in the World, also a collection of poetry, The Laughing Dove and Other Poems, the novel, A Tree for the Birds, and most recently, the award-winning novel, On That Wave of Gulls. Vernon, we are so happy to have you in the studio with us. Hello and welcome.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Vernon, we're going to jump right in and ask you, how has your writing week been?
It hasn't been that great, to be frank. I've just got a new architectural project to do on the Atlantic seaboard, and I needed to sit down and spend a few days sketching. But I find when I'm sketching buildings, particularly right at the beginning when I'm trying to understand the site and what the building's going to do on the site, I tend to do quite a bit of writing in between that. So I'll capture all of that, the scribbles, and it'll feed into my new novel. So it's been one of those sort of kind of strange cross-pollination weeks.
And Vernon, when you are deep into a project, you are writing a novel or a piece of creative nonfiction, what does your writing week look like?
It all depends on whether I've got some architectural stuff to do, but I try and take a couple of weeks and just sit and write every day and get consumed by the writing. And in fact, I've just gone up to the Kruger National Park for 3 weeks, where I sat in a little hut up on a hill and looked out over the bushveld and wrote, worked on the new novel, which was about certain things, that place, that sense of place that I needed to be in. And place is important to me when I'm writing.
Mm. And Vernon, when you're writing like that, what kind of writing aims do you have? Do you work to a word count a day, or do you just try and do a little bit of work a day? How do you work?
The way I write has sort of evolved. If I think back to my first book and now where I am in the sort of evolution of it all. And what I find I do is I start from the beginning every time. So I start the book, or I start the story, and I start writing. And if I get into the first chapter, the second chapter, I go from the beginning, and I let the story tell me where it wants to go. And then I'll work on it for days like that, going along, and then leave it, then come back to it and start from the beginning all over again until I get to where I left off. And strangely, what happens to me is I get to see something else in the character, a particular character that I only found out later on, so I can layer it back into the story at the beginning. And I do that about 20 or 30 times in writing the book. So I kind of start again every single time.
And that starting again, is that you go and reread what you've written and add and build, or do you rewrite it?
So I reread what I've written, and I do add and I build, but I mean, I can add quite substantially. So for example, the first sentence might suddenly become a new chapter, or the 10th sentence might become 5 chapters.
Oh, goodness.
But I always start from the beginning, and it's just, I found it's that has opened up this technique of weaving, which I find fantastic. In the style of writing that I'm exploring, in the structure of the novel that I'm exploring, which is very much to do with a fractured narrative. So I need to keep the reader, on some sort of a narrative arc, some sort of a journey through the novel, some sort of a progression. But I want to go off and discover characters and subplots and sub-stories. So it's kind of a collage that needs to take you from A to Z.
Okay.
At least that's where I am now in the writing.
So your first piece of published long-form writing was The Search for the Rarest Bird in the World. Was that your first piece of writing, or had you written before that?
It was my first piece of writing that I knew I was doing, because I used to... When I make a building, I used to write a bit about that building. So my buildings are very much a narrative. The site tells me what the building wants to be. And I used to do that for 20 years, not realizing that I was making little stories when I was making buildings. It was only when I went on an expedition to look for a bird, came back and got interviewed by the Argus, and the reporter said, you know, you should think about writing this down. And I went home the next day and started writing it down.
I just want to go back, and if you can tell us a little bit about your origin story. You've referred to the fact that you're an architect, but maybe if you can tell us what did you start out wanting to be as a child? Did you think of writing? How did you come to architecture? What is your superhero origin story?
It's interesting because I've thought about it a lot. I didn't want to be an architect. That's the last thing I ever wanted to be, because my father was an architect, my sister is an architect, my brother-in-law and cousins, everybody around me are architects, and I didn't want to be like everybody else. I wanted to be an ornithologist. I wanted to study birds and be in nature. That was my dream from when I was a little boy. And my father was very shrewd, because he let me, so I refused to do art at school. I refused to do history. I barely read a book. I just did biology and science and all this kind of thing. And when it got to matric, and I'd finished matric, my dad said, right, what do you want to be? And I said, well, I mean, obviously I want to be an ornithologist. He said, he has an idea. Why don't you do post-matric at school and choose three subjects and do this new thing called computer science, do your biology, and try art. So I did A-levels in those three subjects, and halfway through the first term, I came to my dad and said, Dad, I want to be an architect. So I fell in love with Roman and Greek art and architecture. And then I hurriedly had to put a portfolio together for UCT, not having ever drawn anything in my life, because they accept you on your portfolio. And I got into architectural school, and I loved it. I still love it, but it's one part of me. Mm. All I really want to do is write books. That's all I want to do now.
And what's happened to the birds? Do you still want to be an ornithologist too?
Well, I've never left the birds. So I sit on the board of the Fitzpatrick Institute of African Ornithology at UCT. I was the chairman of the biggest bird conservation NGO in Africa. I write about birds. I've contributed to some ornithological work over the years. So I'm intimately involved in all of that. I'm vice chairman of Africa's biggest bird magazine, and I'm intimately involved in birds all the time, and I go and chase birds all over the world. In fact, when I won that prize for the on that wave of gulls, they gave me this 100,000 rand cash, and I didn't know what to do with it. I mean, my wife had ideas, but I wasn't sure what to do, and then it came to me. I want to go and see the rarest seabird in the world. So I went to China on an expedition, and I'm one of a very few people in the world to have seen the Chinese crested tern. So birds it's part of my life, but it all feeds into the writing.
I love that story.
I was just telling Gail before this interview that when you and I were recently in Venezuela, you made us all look up and look at the bird life, and it was so remarkable. Because it wouldn't occur to me in a city to look up and see the birds. And there really were some remarkable birds there.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing about looking at birds, it's a way of seeing. It's a way of reading the landscape. It's a way of reading the world and connecting, as is the way that an architect sees. And a writer, too. So when we were in Venezuela, and I saw these blue and yellow macaws flying up the main street of this huge city, I couldn't help but look up. And I've since actually done a bit of research on these birds. They don't even occur in the Caracas region. They occur in southeastern Venezuela. And they were introduced to Caracas in 1977 as pets. And they have now claimed the city. So you have a city full of macaws that, you know, it's a feral species. It's like our pigeons in Cape Town, except they've got macaws.
And like the parakeets in Johannesburg, like those
yes, precisely.
Parakeets. Yeah.
And absolutely. And if you so these strange interactions between nature and us in cities, they're full of stories. And whether it's birds or trees or butterflies or verges in a city, the connections with nature in cities is one of the things I want to dedicate the rest of my life to, because it tells our story. And I mentioned this even in Venezuela when I was reading Ivan Vladislavich's book about Johannesburg, his new one, True North. He constantly refers to trees and plants and open spaces on his walks, and he doesn't do that lightly. It's a big part of his story because it's a big part of us.
Yeah, you're making me want to go for a walk. Vernon, I have just listened to a podcast, an episode of This American Life, and the title of the podcast was Spark Bird. And what I learned is that every bird lover, every bird watcher apparently has a spark bird, the bird that started out their love of birds, the first one they remember as, this is the bird that got me into it. Do you have a spark bird?
I do. I do indeed. And I mention it in the book, The Search for the Rarest Bird in the World. When I was 5 years old, my grandparents used to have a farm in Northcliffe, when Northcliffe used to be flower farms, that area. And I was walking through the fields with my grandfather in the mist one early morning, and I heard this call. And it goes something like this, doo 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 doo. And that's the call of the rainbird, my grandfather said. And he said, remember that call? And he gave me a name, Rainbird. And as a little boy, I was able to imagine what this bird might look like. And it had this fantastic name and this weird call. And as the mist lifted, on top of this bush was sitting this Burchell's cuckoo, with these bright red shining eyes like glowing coals. And so the rainbird became Burchell's cuckoo, but I'd fashioned it in my mind before I saw it. And I'm convinced that was the beginning of my writing career. It was the beginning of a way of seeing. It was the beginning of me wanting to be an architect, wanting to connect with the natural world. All of those things happened with that bird. And ever since then, I've been in love with the natural world.
I love that story.
Yeah. I've got a little shiver.
Your book, The Search for the Rarest Bird in the World, is, I have to say, one of the most remarkable pieces of creative nonfiction that I have read in a long time. And I'm so happy it is getting a second life as a paperback release in time for Christmas now. And as I was reading it, I was thinking that this story is a bit like travel writing, in as much as one has to decide how to get into the story. Do you get in via yourself as a kind of character in the story, via the people that you are with, the landscape that you see, the natural world, the birds, and you manage to do all these things? How did you decide which factors to highlight at which times in the narrative? Were you using this kind of weaving and interleaving technique already in that first narrative?
No, I didn't know anything about weaving when I wrote that book. I didn't know anything about writing. I just sat down and knew I wanted to write the story of this kind of adventure, going to look for the rarest bird in the world. But what I really wanted to write about was why I watch birds, why I'm intrigued with that way of seeing and that way of connecting, and the importance of naming and how we as a species navigate our existence by having to name things, whether they're mountains, rivers, cities, or our children. But it's a way of navigating our existence. And bird watchers love names. Bird watchers love to know the names of everything, every tree, every mountain, every bird. And it intrigued me. Why do I want to do that? And what is this need to collect? Why must I collect these names? Why do I need to have a list of birds? Why do I risk my life going to see a bird in some strange place where you get shot at? Why do that? So this book was trying to answer questions for myself. So as I wrote it, I was trying to explain why I've dedicated my life Because at that stage of my life, I wasn't a writer. Why have I dedicated my life to looking for the rarest birds in the world?
Vernon, can you tell us a little bit more about the getting shot at? I mean, I love that that's a throwaway phrase not a lot of us get to say, when I was looking for a bird and got shot at and also nearly getting arrested or getting arrested. Tell us a little bit about how these bird adventures happened?
I can. Bird watching, when people think about bird watching, they think about people in tweed jackets and sitting in parks with picnic baskets and kind of a sort of a, almost a Victorian experience. But birdwatching is an extreme sport. I know people who were eaten by tigers, lost in jungles. All in the pursuit of birds. Because to see the birds, you've got to go into the strangest places. And to see the rarest birds, you've got to go to places where virtually no Western person has ever been. And in Ethiopia, where I had the coordinates of where a wing was found of a bird that nobody had ever seen, but it had a name, I had to go into that place and hire people with AK-47s to make sure I didn't get shot at. Because in some parts of Ethiopia, spears have been traded for AK-47s. So the tribes don't negotiate from valley to valley with spears and shouting at each other. They shoot at each other. So it's kind of this kind of cultural twist that the West has sort of given parts of Africa. And the first feeling that you are in the wrong place is when bullets start pinging off the rocks. And this happened to us in this particular part of southern Ethiopia many years ago. And it's happened in other parts of the world too. But, when you're standing on a bridge down in southern Venezuela in full camo gear with binoculars around your neck and looking like you're some sort of gorilla that stepped over the border from Colombia, they arrest you first and then ask you what birds you're looking for. And and this is one of the many experiences I've had.
I think I'm going to stick with watching the weavers on the bird feeder in my garden.
As an architect, you are involved with the built world, the built universe, but your heart seems to belong to the natural world. Does that tension between the two worlds feed into your writing?
It absolutely does. The tension between making a building and a piece of open land and having to bring those two things together responsibly fits directly into my huge interest when it comes to my writing. And my writing is really about our relationship with light, our relationship with open space, our relationship with the in-between, where the city becomes the non-city, where the land becomes the sea. Where, for example, my new novel, the one set in Cape Town, is all about how a city becomes the ocean, or how a city becomes the mountain, and how we exist within that matrix. So, which is one of the reasons one of the characters had to be a seagull.
What about architecture and writing are the same? And also, do you think you would have been a writer if you hadn't been an architect?
I think I would have been a writer, whatever I'd been, I would have ended up being a writer. When I think back now, because there are clues all the way back to when I was at school, the greatest gift within an architectural education, in my opinion, and I'm going to be talking about this next Tuesday to the architectural community, strangely enough, the greatest gift is architecture teaches you to see in a certain way. It teaches you to read the landscape and read, for example, a city in a certain way. So if I walk into a city, I look at the hierarchy of streets, the widths of streets, where the light's coming from, what people are doing, where they're sitting, where they're talking, where the trees are, where the sounds are coming from. You read the landscape in a quite you interrogate it, and there's a constant narrative when you're looking at things as an architect. And architecture is all about the narrative. And that feeds into how you make architectural decisions and sketch and conceptualize and design. So it's very similar in my experience to the way I write, because I write, I layer the writing with all kinds of questions. What are people doing? How are they behaving? Where is the light? What is this space like? How does it connect to that space? How do people move through a space? And progressions, you know, moving from A to B in a house is critical. When you enter a house, what do you see first? Does your eye go towards natural light when you open the front door? Do you take your eye towards a glittering tree to the left? Must there be a sound of water? All these things take you on a journey through a house, and you've got to conceptualize this as an architect, and that's exactly what writers do.
Very interesting.
Vernon, when I came to read your 2018 novel, A Tree for the Birds, one of the first things I noticed was that it was edited by Henrietta Rose Innes, and then I saw that your most recent book was also edited by her. Now, she is undoubtedly one of our greatest living writers in South Africa. What was that experience like working with her on your novels, and are you someone who takes easily to the editing process, or are you one of the writers who resists it and kind of fights back?
I'm a non-resister. When I wrote my first book, I connected with Henrietta somehow, because we both have sort of a bit of a scientific background in a sense. We both love nature. We both love the little things, the insects and the birds and stuff. And so we have these connections. And then, you know, working with an editor, for me, it's you know, that editor's got to understand where you're coming from and what you're trying to do and who you are. And Henrietta just gets me. I mean, she's got me from the first day. When I wrote this book with this gull, she says, "What's this gull doing here?" I said, "Henrietta, this gull is going nowhere, but this gull is staying here, weaving its way through this novel." She says, "I got you. I get it." So we just sort of get each other, and we're dear friends, and we share work, and she's a very special person, and I'm very grateful to her for editing my books. And when my next book is finished, Henrietta, if you're listening, be calling you.
Vernon, on a similar note, you've done a master's degree in writing and you're doing your PhD, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And talk to me about how you feel this has informed your writing, how necessary you felt it is for the becoming the writer you are.
Okay, so as I've mentioned, I started writing and just wrote a book, and then was in this new world. And I realized that I'm teaching myself how to write all the time, and I do that by reading everything I can get my hands on. So I've got thousands of books. I only started reading books when I was 40. I never read a single book. Not a single book, other than an architectural book or ornithological book. But I never read novels. I never read anything until I was 40. So what I decided to do was read everything I can. So I read all V.S. Naipaul's books, one after the other. I read all Gabriel Garcia Marquez's books, I think, with a second lot. And then I just went through everything I could find. Achebe's work, everyone. And then I got stuck into poetry, and I read everything Walcott ever wrote, and Seelen, and everyone. And I keep reading everything. So I've taught myself to write by reading everything I get my hands on. But that still wasn't enough, because my huge interest is the structure of a book. That's where I want to take my journey as a writer. And although I'm reading all these writers, and it's teaching me styles and how you breathe when you write and where commas should go and why that should be a colon, etc., I was fascinated in the structure of the novel. So I thought, let me try this MA and see if I can learn something about that. And you know, when you've got a formal teacher, and I had a fantastic teacher in Imran Kuvadia, throwing things, he introduced me to Knausgård, for example, throwing things at me about the structure of the novel. It's taken my writing in a certain direction, and it's going to continue in that direction. And this PhD is going to unpack the collage in writing, the fractured narrative. How it's possible to insert an essay within a novel, for example, and you don't even notice. Knausgård does that. How to switch from the first person to the third person with totally different characters starting those chapters, someone else speaking to you in the middle of a book. It fascinates me. And the power of music in the novel.
When you were writing A Tree for the Birds, or rather when I was reading it, I thought I was reading a very interesting piece of fiction, and then I started getting clues that this was based somehow on a true story. Can you tell us what the inspiration was for that story, and what bits are kind of fiction and what are nonfiction?
Okay, so I spent quite a bit of time in Brazzaville, in the Republic of Congo, going up and down this very long and very deep river, the deepest river in the world. I mean, 150 meters deep in places. But I went up and down that river on a gunboat with guys with machine guns and various ministers of government of that corrupt part of the world, taking me up and down the river, trying to explain to me why I needed to create Monte Carlo for them on the Congo River. And it interested me. And then I met this strange pastor who had chicken farms outside Brazzaville, and he would sell these chickens at exorbitant prices to the poor people in the city. I met a little boy who was in love with the garden in the back of a little house in the middle of this squalor. And the wonderful thing is, I knew I wanted to write a book about that part of the world because I was fascinated with how a city grows up against such a river. And then all these threads and bits and pieces that I've just described informed the need to write a story about liminality, really.
Can you unpack that for us?
Mm.
So I think the most powerful thought I have in my mind when I write is the in-between, is where one thing becomes another thing, but just before it becomes that other thing. That for me is the most creative moment. So if you can imagine, and I'll just use an example of where Cape Town becomes the sea, that beach, that tidal interface, it's fascinating to me. And where a city in the middle of West Africa is divided from another city, so Kinshasa and Brazzaville are almost one city divided by this 120 meter trench full of water. And that river is a sovereign boundary drawn on a map by the West. So you've got one family cut in half by someone's pencil on a piece of paper many years ago. That fascinates me. That in between fascinates me, where one country becomes the other country. That fascinates me. There's a story there. And for that boundary to actually be a river where people move up and down on boats, ignoring the boundary in many instances, it fascinated me. And so this whole physical notion of the in-between, and then the psychological notion of it and the philosophical notion of it is where I'm trying to take my writing.
Yeah, very interesting. Vernon, I couldn't help noticing that when I read up about you, everything you do is award-winning. You don't do things unless you do them to a standard of excellence. Would that be a correct assessment of your character?
My wife would confirm this.
Do you wash dishes beautifully?
Absolutely. No, the thing is, I was brought up in quite a conservative home. So I wanted to please my mom and dad. So I wanted to try my best at school. So I tried my best in the classroom. I tried my best on the sports field. And I just tried my best because I thought that was the right thing to do when I was little. And the great gift that my father gave me, and he gave me many gifts, but the great gift he gave me was to say, look, whatever you do, just try your best. try your best, because then you will know that that's, you know, you've done what you can do, and that's what you can put out in the world. And he said to me, if you live your life like that, you will have an interesting life, you'll have a rewarding life, and you will attract people around you who are trying their best.
So in A Tree for the Birds, your main character is Chris Nelt, this Congolese boy, and you write very much in his character. You see things through his eyes, you experience his whole life from birth to death, and you put it on the page for us. And that process of being a white man writing this character is something that's become quite in dispute in recent years. I don't know how much it was part of the conversation in 2018, but how did you do that? How did you think yourself into that character? And did you get any pushback from anyone questioning your right, in a way, to tell that story?
It's such a hugely important question, that, and it is something that I've wrestled with throughout this writing journey that I've been on. And I've come to the conclusion that as a writer, you need to free yourself up. And if you write sensitively about a character from your heart, with love, with a sense of responsibility, you'll be okay. And if you want to write stories, particularly as a white middle-aged man in Africa, you're going to have characters in the book from different cultures, from diverse ways of seeing men, women, black, white, different religions. It's going to be necessary in order for you to tell stories, and you need to make a decision, in my opinion, to just do that with integrity and with sensitivity. And sometimes you actually need to portray white people behaving badly, because you have the freedom and the right. So some of my characters can be rather despicable white racists. I'm allowed to do that. But when it comes to characters from other cultures, I must be terribly sensitive, terribly respectful, and that will do justice to the story.
That's very interesting, that perspective, that it's when you write in your own world, you can be harsher, you can let your characters get nasty. I never thought about it before, and it's a very interesting.
The reason I do that, it's part of my responsibility, because it's true.
It is true.
I mean, it's true. So you know, and the truth can be quite powerful, especially when one has the license to do that as a middle-aged white man who's benefited from apartheid. It's my responsibility to show some despicableness.
So speaking of your most despicable character in On That Wave of Gulls, you have three characters telling the story. You have, as you've mentioned, the seagull. You have a man that we could describe as a Bahi. We could describe him as of Khoi heritage. He's a drifter. Conventional society sees him as mad, or, you know, outside the bonds of acceptable society. But by the end of the book, we're really questioning who really is mad in this story, and it's maybe not him. And then you have this white male middle-aged architect who is the villain of the piece. But you've put so much of your biographical details into him that I was completely fascinated by this character. What did you draw on for him? Was it a kind of a shadow self of yourself? Was it your own id? Or was it something you've observed in people around you?
I think it's all of those things, Fiona, because one of the things that frees me up to write and to enjoy the writing is honesty, truth, all that kind of stuff. Just opening yourself up and just being naked. It helps me get into the thing. And being an architect in Cape Town and experiencing the kind of toxicity that exists within our beautiful city, where you have incredible wealth and incredible poverty, where you have huge walls. Behind them are glittering palaces, and then there's people sleeping on the street. And being part of that, being one of the people that makes those walls, being one of the people that designs these giant penises on the Atlantic seaboard, I have to incorporate that into my story, especially because I wanted to use this architect because he understands the texture and structure of a city better than anyone. But he's a damaged person. He's actually abused, and he's which is comes, you know, it works its way through the novel. But I drew on all that stuff. I drew on some of the despicable clients I've had, and some of the wonderful clients. A number of architects I know are in this book, and it's going to be very interesting for me next Tuesday when I talk to the entire architectural community of Cape Town about this book, because you know, it's going to be interesting. Put it that way.
You're all there and you're all bad.
Oh dear.
Vernon, I'm always interested when somebody writes as you do in different genres. You write poetry, you write fiction, you write narrative nonfiction. When the spark of an idea comes to you, and it feels to me like your spark is always a spark bird, but when the spark of an idea comes to you, how do you know which path it's taking you on, and when do you know?
Okay, so I don't know where it's going to take me, and that's why I go on that journey. So if I can just use an example of the novel that I'm working on at the moment, I'm absolutely fascinated by sunsets. And so I knew I wanted to write a book about that, and that was good enough for me.
Okay.
So I'm going to dedicate the next 2 or 3 years of my life to trying to understand sunsets.
You've got to unpack that for me more.
Okay, so what fascinates me about sunsets, yes, is that how people see them differently. So one person might look at a sunset and say, oh, that's pretty, and raise their wine glass and have a sip. Another person might look at that sunset and think, oh my gosh, there is a God after all. This is an almighty sign from the heavens and all that kind of stuff. Another person might look at the sunset and think, well, that's the end of today. What's going to happen tomorrow? And I'm interested in all those ways of seeing. And I think, once again, it visits my passionate interrogation of liminality. Mm. Where the day becomes the night, there is a sunset. What is that?
I have to tell you that apparently this is a generational thing. My children tell me this. Every time I go, oh my God, look at the sunset, they go, we get it, we get it. The sky's not blue, we get it.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. So it's a fascinating thing, and I'm interested in it. So that's what I'm looking at the moment.
Well, I was very interested in the interplay between your evil architect and his wife, Charlotte. She, and also the very dramatic end of their relationship by the end of the novel.
You're not allowed to do spoiler alerts.
Well, I just said it was dramatic. I didn't say what happens. I don't think anyone will believe me if I say what happens. But Charlotte remains essentially unknowable to him. She's a kind of unknown quantity. She attracts him and attracts his thoughts and his interests, but she is fundamentally unknowable. Is that something that you believe exists between genders? Are the genders unknowable to each other?
I think in some instances, in a number of instances, that is the case, particularly in instances of abuse, where if you can imagine, and let me just use this story, this image of this beautiful seagull sitting on a railing with the sea behind it, and it's got this elegant streamlined form designed for flight. It's exquisite. But as you walk up to it, wanting to touch it, it just flies beyond your reach to the next railing. That's the relationship that this man has with his wife. So there's a disconnect. There's a misunderstanding of what beauty is. There's a misunderstanding of who's controlling who is dominating who. And it's just an altogether toxic way of loving or wanting to connect with others in the world. And it fascinates me.
And you think it is inherent in the relationship between men and women?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I think men and women can love each other in this profoundly beautiful, wonderful, deep, incredible way because of perhaps different ways of seeing, different ways of touching the world. There's this incredible. It's like the night and the day, and when they come together, they create the sunset.
I love the way you brought it back to sunsets, because I was wondering, how am I going to get us back to the sunsets? Because I'm stuck on the sunset idea. And I'm stuck on it because Fiona and I are both very interested in the process of writing, but I'm possibly a little bit more stuck on it than Fiona is. And I've kind of got stuck on thinking, how do you take an idea that is so abstract? Sunset, liminal spaces, the meeting of the ocean and the land, and turn it into a story that can be in a novel. So how is the sunset going to become a novel?
Okay, I'm not going to answer that because you're going to have to read that novel when it's finished.
Yeah.
But can I use on that wave of goals to answer your question? So I had this idea of where the land meets the sea, and there's this in-between thing, and there's a novel that needs to come out of that. And that was the first thought. Then I read one of Derek Walcott's poems where he talks about the sea in this most evocative way. He says the waves are the pages of the ocean. And so now automatically I've created a scene in my mind of waves being part of this language of the liminal, but they're holding, protecting, bringing information from the sea to the land. And that gave me the idea of the seagull that might be able to see those waves in that way. And that in fact, when the seagull looks at the waves, the seagull doesn't see waves, but poetry. So the seagulls of the world see waves as poems. And there became another scene of the book. So if that helps you, how I layer the story, it begins with an idea. And this is very much like architecture. It begins with a line on the page. As soon as you draw that line on the page, you've got two sides to the line of white open space. Now you're beginning to become an architect, because that's the beginning of architectural space. So that's how I began that book. And I will begin the sunset book in the same way. I have begun it. I've finished writing it. Mm-hmm. And then Fiona said it was too short, so now it's already another 10,000 words longer.
glad to hear it, yes.
If Fiona tells
you it's going to get longer. It's going to get longer. Don't worry. It gets longer each time.
Vernon, I wanted to ask you about your career as a poet. Was that a phase in your career, or is it still something that you do? And when you get an idea, do you immediately know, oh, this is going to be a poem, or this is going to be more of a long form thing?
Yeah, I still write poems all the time, and I'm collecting a whole lot to hopefully do another collection sometime. Some of the poems might become short stories. Some might become a novel. And sometimes I'll redo the old poems and turn them into new ones. You know, there's no rules when it comes to me in poems. And I write them all the time for my buildings. And I absolutely love poetry. And it's a fantastic, quick way for me to create something that I want to keep and look at.
I love that sentence. I write them all the time for my buildings. I love the possessive my buildings and this idea of you in a relationship with your buildings writing a poem for them.
I do that, yes. And I sometimes drive past them quietly in my car and sit and look at some of them and see how they've changed.
And write a new poem for them, maybe.
Yes, indeed.
So as you are in this very creative phase in your life, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression on you?
Well, I've got three books next to my bed that I'm busy reading at the moment. The one is called Creative Cities in Africa, and it's a critical architectural piece on urbanism, but it talks about cities in the most wonderful way. And it's by a friend of mine, Professor Nolene Murray. It talks about cities of the imagination. So although as architects we can discuss cities that exist like Cape Town or Caracas or Brazzaville, we can also create real cities in our imagination. And I'm fascinated by that architectural analysis of cities because it's an architectural question. So I'm busy reading that book. I'm also revisiting Divisadero by Michael Ondaatje because of this interest I have with collage. And then because I'm busy with the PhD, I'm reading The Lily of the Field and The Bird of the Air by Soren Kierkegaard, because he talks about he unpacks three sermons, and I'm convinced there's one of my sunset answers in there.
That's fascinating. I'm very taken with your reading list. It feels to me, and I know we're not supposed to ask questions of this, but do you ever read just for the story? Like, do you ever read a quick murder?
No, I never read for pleasure.
How interesting.
I read to try and teach myself about this world that I want to dedicate the rest of my life to. Every book I read, I'm not interested in a story for pleasure. I'd rather watch a film. And that's one of the great challenges. That's one of the great challenges for us as novelists. We have to be more relevant than the cinema. We have to understand the devices in cinema that hold you so easily with popcorn on your lap, because we need to take people back to the novel.
Vernon, this has been fascinating. Thank you. I've enjoyed myself so much.
Me too. And we hope that everyone will check out On That Wave of Gulls, which is still out in bookstores. And I really hope that everyone will buy The Search for the Rarest Bird in the World when it becomes available in paperback. It is a fantastic gift for basically anyone in your life. Vernon, this has been so, so interesting. Thank you so much for your time. Gail, I think you'll agree with me that Vernon has a very interesting mind, and if one reads his books, you get to see that mind at work on the page. What did you take from that discussion?
So much. I mean, he does have an interesting mind, and I'm like a broken record on this, but one of the things about doing this podcast is just being exposed to how different people's minds work, how differently people see the world, and how different everyone's journey is. And I think one of the things that really like almost stopped me in my tracks was mm-hmm. that he didn't start reading until he was 40. Mm. And you know, when I talk about writing, I often say there's only one rule, which is that you must sit down and write. Mm-hmm. But a close second is that you must read.
Yes.
And I find it fascinating that a writer has come out of someone who was such a late reader. Mm-hmm. It also gave me hope for my children. Like, maybe it's okay if you don't read in your teens.
Yes.
And you know, he talked about the challenge of the cinema as the kind of, we've got to get people away from the cinema. I think these days it's actually TikTok more than the mm-hmm. cinema mm-hmm. that we have to get them away from. And it kind of gave me a hope that just because you don't start reading young doesn't mean you will never find that joy of reading. Mm, mm. Although another aspect was, I said joy of reading there. Mm-hmm. He doesn't approach reading as a joy. That yes. was very interesting for me. For me, reading is all about escape, all about pleasure, I get very angry when I have to read for a purpose other than my own pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, that's not part of it at all. So that was fascinating to me.
It certainly was. And the part that fascinated me, which is also very different to how I approach writing and also how you approach writing, which is he can take something like sunsets and turn that into a book.
Mm.
I wouldn't even know how to start. How do sunsets become a premise, and how does that become a plot?
Mm.
And in a way, he detailed it because he talked about different people looking at sunsets in a different way. The one person who sees it just as the end of the day, the one who sees it as proof that God exists, the one who sees it as the most beautiful, life-affirming thing ever. And there you have potentially, I don't know how Vernon's going to approach this book, but potentially those are three characters.
I mean, for me, I could see how you'd get a long form article out of that,
or
a short story.
Mm-hmm.
I will be very interested to see how it can become a book, because for me, I need a what if, and then I need to complicate my what if, and what if there's a sunset and it gets complicated? I suppose you could get a premise there, but I don't think that's where he's going at all.
It's not really a sunset. It's actually a nuclear explosion. And what's going to happen next?
We could write a book starting with a sunset.
But so, so fascinating to see. I think this season has really shown us that people see the world differently to how we see it, and people approach writing differently to how we do.
Without a doubt, that I've felt that more this season than previous seasons. It's interesting.
Well, we have something interesting in our inbox today from Anonymous, and the question goes like this. Hi, Gail and Fiona. Love listening to the podcast. I also listen to other podcasts which have been discussing the idea of a beach read. What is a beach read? What does that mean? Does it have to be set on a beach? Gail, do you have thoughts on this?
So it's an expression I often use, a beach read or a summer read or an aeroplane read, I think actually is maybe the same thing. And for me, it's the kind of book that is easy to read in that you are immersed in a plot quickly and thoroughly and you don't want to put it down, but it doesn't take too much intellect, that you can read it on the beach or in the aeroplane or while you're on holiday, and it adds to your pleasure enormously. But if you called away to go scuba diving or whatever wonderful things you're doing on your holiday on your beach, it's okay. You'll be able to pick it up because it was a gripping plot and you'll remember it. That's what it is for me. What about you?
Well, I've been... This term is in the zeitgeist at the moment, and I've seen some discussion about it in the New York Times. And somebody who might have been Curtis Sittenfeld, but I'm speaking under correction here, said that she, at a stage in her career, very much objected to being called a writer of summer reads. And now she's completely flipped and changed her mind and realized that the summer, which for us and for the Northern Hemisphere is when you are on holiday, when most people have leisure and are on holiday, is when you have the leisure to concentrate on a book, when you can sort of shut everything out and sit down with a book and read for a long period of uninterrupted time. And she suddenly realized it's a compliment to her books to call them summer reads. They're the books that people read when they have the space to give their attention to a book. So that was another way of looking at it.
Which sounds like it's contradicting what I'm saying, but I don't think it is entirely. You know, it's when you've got time to be absorbed by a story, to be totally transported by that story. I think it's the greatest compliment that a book can be given. Is if someone says to me, you know, I read your book on the aeroplane and it was perfect for the aeroplane. That is not an insult. That is a compliment. It's something that took their mind off the fact that they were on a 10-hour journey with nothing to do. And there can be no greater compliment.
And of course, it has become a very gendered term. It's mostly women writers who get called summer reads, beach reads, aeroplane reads, etc.
I think men get called aeroplane. It's summer and beach are women.
Yes, and Dan Brown is maybe an aeroplane read.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
It is interesting. So please keep the questions coming. We love seeing what's on your minds. We love thinking about them and answering them. And we hope everyone checks out Vernon Head's books, especially The Search for the Rarest Bird in the World, which is about to be re-released and will make a fantastic gift for anyone in your life.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.